Well, folks, welcome to one more edition of Politics and Random. Humberto Willis, your host. Thank you so kindly for being a part of the show. We are going to have a great show for you today.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Have a hell of an interview, a new book that is out by Tracy McMillan called The White Bonus. I think you guys are going to love this interview. I went a bit longer than I expected it to. Should have been a 17 to 20 minute interview. It turned out being a 33 minute interview. I think you're going to like it. Anyway, we are going to get busy and start the interview as soon as I salute all my great people in the chat. First of all, Yvette Avery Herrod, La Belleza de Atlanta, Georgia. How are you doing? Our favorite union operative, the ones who really get things done. AVQ, El Señor Rudnin, Michael Rudnin in Brooklyn, New York. Yvette, of course, is in Atlanta, Georgia. Melanie Keelan is in Barcelona, Spain. Good afternoon and welcome. We also have in the house Lee Grant from Montgomery County, Eric Hayes from Kingwood Atascocita, and E2247, the relatives of us all from all over the place. Welcome aboard, my brothers and my sisters. We have a great show for you today. But anyhow, let's see if there's anything I need to catch on before we get that video going. But I think, again, like I said, you are going to find it quite enlightening and quite interesting. Who else is in the house? I'm searching. Nobody else new to talk about. Well, let's go ahead and get busy with the interview because it's going to take a bit of time. And then we'll get back and start with you all. Welcome to one more edition of Politics and Right. I'm Humberto Willis, your host. Today, we have the honor of speaking to somebody special who wrote a special book. You guys are going to love this interview. Tracy McMillan is a renowned investigative journalist who has been reporting on the multiracial American working class for more than two decades. Her debut, The American Way of Eating, won a Sidney Hillman Book Prize, was a James Beard Foundation Award finalist, and was compared to Nickel and Dime by Dwight Gardner of the New York Times. McMillan's new book, The White Bonus, Five Families and the Cash Value of Racism in America by Tracy McMillan, combines rigorous journalism with a vulnerable, probing memoir. In it, she poses an urgent question. If racism denies people of color so much, here's the question. Just how much does it give white people, not an amorphous privilege, but in dollars and cents? It's my pleasure to have you here. Tracy, how are you doing this morning?
I'm really well, Alberto. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Look, I've been intrigued with the book. I hadn't been able to read. It's one of the better documented books. I mean, everything is annotated. I mean, I don't know why there's no question that everything that you did in this book seemed to have some basis in fact that people can cross check, double check the whole works. That is journalism that you don't see today. So thanks for writing the book.
Thanks.
Now tell me, why did you do it?
Yeah, I wanted a better way to talk about my experience in the world, right? I'm a white person who didn't grow up with a ton of money. But I understand that racism is a thing in the world and it happens. And when there would be these conversations about white privilege, I would get sort of stuck, right? Because I'd be like, well, I'm not Elon Musk. My parents didn't bankroll me through college and give me a down payment. Like, what did being white really get me, right? Because so often when we talk about white privilege, we're really talking about racial and class privilege, right? We're saying like, oh, your parents paid for all these things, blah, blah, blah. But actually, you know, most white people in America don't have parents who are bankrolling them, right? So what does that stuff look like for me and for us? And I also just felt like, you know, we need to be honest about how racism works if we're going to dismantle it. It seems really clear that racism is, you know, impoverishing our democracy. It's eviscerating our safety net. It's making life worse and worse for many people, not just people of color. And I wanted to understand both what I got, so then I could also talk about what it costs us.
Now, the reality is, in these times, in the times of Trump, in the times of you will not replace us and all these types of things, it is not an easy thing to do, because you're a white person. You can just, you know, go with the flow, whether you're, I mean, you don't really have to put yourself at risk to write something like this. Did you have any concerns as far as what it would do for you career-wise or other to write such a book?
I mean, not when I pitched it, right? I mean, I pitched the book in 2019. I got a sizable contract, right, that let me work on the book full time for the last several years. I mean, I had to take out a loan and things like that to get through. This gets into the weeds about how book payments work, right? But, mm-hmm. you know, I got significant enough interest from publishers that I thought, well, like, their job is to find books that will sell and be important. So that seems okay. I mean, and I love my work as a journalist, but I'm a freelance independent journalist. I'm not bought into the larger institutions the way that somebody who's on staff somewhere is, right? So maybe it hurts my career in some small way, but it just doesn't seem, there's some ways in which, like, my career is not, it's not like my career is so deeply valuable, right? That, you know, if it goes a little sideways, I mean, I'm always finding other ways to make money. So.
Well, actually, I do think it's, I beg to differ. I think this is one of the, again, in reading how it came from you, I think this is one of the most important books that's been written right now. And one of the reasons, and I don't know if you follow what I do, but there's a paragraph in your book that I said, oh my God, these are the things that I speak about almost on a daily time in my thing. And it goes as follows. There are so many things that I could not see. I could not yet see how many assumptions that I was not supposed to get food stamps came from racism and other forms of cruelty. I'd internalized things that ran so deeply I could not have told you they were there. I would have told you that they were not for me because I was educated and had options. But the shameful truth is that I did not think food stamps were for people like me, because I felt material need was something that only really happened to people that were not white. And let me tell you something. Today on my KPFT program in Houston, in getting a thing across to some of the my white audience, it was I kind of mentioned the Appalachian story and let them understand that one of the reasons many of them could have the feelings that they had is because they couldn't see themselves in Appalachia, because they didn't know about Appalachia. What a book like yours do is it opens the door for things that people think and just let aside, but you give them a reason to think a bit deeper, which is why I loved what you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much, Brigitte. That's really, thank you for telling me that. You know, I think that's one of the reasons that doing this book as memoir was really important, because so much of the way that white Americans engage with questions around race and deserving and the role of government, all that, there's a lot of deeply internalized thinking about race and equity there. And, you know, I'm a good reporter, but pulling that out of multiple strangers, right, that takes years of work. And I didn't feel like I had enough time to pull that out of strangers, and that I could do a better job if I was just pulling it out of myself. So that's really special that seems to have worked.
Yeah, actually, it does. You've written about white resentment and white poor for places like New York Times. What did you learn about white grievance in reporting the white bonus? And explain what the white bonus is, because a lot of people would likely mistake the white bonus and white privilege. Intertwine, but different.
Right. So the white bonus is a variation or subset of white privilege that's very specific, right? So white privilege is kind of this amorphous thing where we say, oh, well, you have white privilege, but do you have class privilege? Do you have able-bodied privilege, right? And you get stuck in these stupid arguments about, like, which oppression is worse, right? And I didn't want to have that conversation. I said, okay, well, if we figure out a way just back of the envelope to measure what people get for being white in terms of money, that might change the conversation a little bit, right? So the white bonus is a rough back of the envelope estimate of the amount of money an individual white person got or saved because of white supremacy and public policy or private practice, right? So that can be money that you inherit from your parents that they had because there was discrimination in mortgage lending that worked in their favor, right? Like that sort of stuff, as well as, you know, employment discrimination.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
That works in my favor, housing discrimination that works in my favor, all of those things, right? And then, you know, there's enough social science to sort of be able to say, well, I don't know exactly how much that definitely meant, but I do know that, say, the wage premium for a white person over a Black person, right, is, I mean, I think it's generally speaking at least 10 to 20 points, mm-hmm. right? And so, all right, well, like if I was making $1 an hour, then that's, you know, 20 points above what a Black person is making. So I was making 20 cents on the dollar more, right? And then calculating that out.
And you did that too. Like I said, you the chart that you did where you, I mean, that chart was great. The chart that you have in the book, I think it's titled The Tracy's White Bonus. I love the way you, and then you separated it into white bonus and white bonus family, white bonus social. And I tell you why that is important. I think that is important because you were able to come a lot of this from a personal standpoint. A lot of people think when people talk about this subject like yourself, that they are talking in some abstract fashion. You're sitting down in an ivory tower talking about this stuff. A lot of this stuff, you've lived it. Now, talking about the bonus as an example, I had a friend, a good friend, a white guy. Both of us started business together. We went to the same bank to get $40,000. They invited him in. He had no collateral. He got the $40,000 loan. They looked at me and told me, don't even bother filling out an application because, you know, you don't have collateral. So I financed my business on 18 to 22% credit card debt, while he financed his on 6% debt. You know, these are things that when you came out and put that numerically out, you show, you know, and again, coming from someone like you, it's like, oh, wait a minute, I can actually see it. And very rarely do you find that authors are able to self-instantiate the things that they're talking about. You brought in subjects. How did you find them?
Yeah, so it was really important, actually, that I had the first person stuff when I went out to find people to work on this book. You know, journalists, you're sort of trained to be like, okay, you go and you find strangers and you say, hey, stranger, you're having this experience that I don't know anything about. I need you to tell me about it so I can tell other people, right? But it would be a little, it'd be a little much for me to go up to other white people and be like, hey, stranger, you're white. I don't know anything about that. Would you right? Who would trust me? Right. So I just felt like I had to do the first person stuff. And then finding the subjects, right? That was a mix of people I already had some personal connection to, and the more traditional journalistic routes of like going through advocacy organizations or sort of other professional contacts, right? So for instance, I have a chapter that's about a union nurse in Pittsburgh, right? She's a member leader with SEIU. And so I had gone to SEIU and said, hey, this is the project that I'm working on. I know you guys do a lot of thinking about how race works with your members, particularly in Pittsburgh, because that is a majority white city. So even though SEIU is mostly people of color, right? They have a lot of white members there. Do you have anyone that might want to talk to me? Right. And so they helped me find somebody and then really just left me alone, right? Which was great. When I went to find the millennial women in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, right, who'd gone through the public schools as they were resegregating. Those are folks that, you know, my first book, right, was about food. So I was friends with people in sort of the world of food in Mississippi. So I knew a bunch of journalists and writers and photographers and started reaching out and being like, does anybody know anyone?
Let me break a second to say that, because you talk about that first book actually brought some of this, the subject of racism into your, not into your vision, but that it helped in you developing this book here. Why is that?
Yeah. So the first book, right, I worked undercover in 3 jobs in the food system. So I was a farm worker in California, a Walmart worker in Michigan, and an Applebee's worker in Brooklyn. And it meant that, you know, 2 of those 3 jobs, I was the only white person in the workplace. And in the Walmart job, right, it was an integrated workplace, right, both Black and white and Hispanic workers there. And so to write that book, right, where I similarly used myself as a central narrative, right, I really had to think about why my job experience looked the way that it did, which meant I had to think a lot about both my race and my gender, right? And something that I really actually enjoy and appreciate about working class, like America, is that there's a much more direct articulation of race, right? People are much more comfortable. I mean, often in ways that in elite circles would be considered offensive, right? But you make a lot of jokes with each other about like, oh, what kind of guys are you into dating, right? Like that's a very like an integrated like female spaces, right? You make a lot of jokes about like, are you dating Black guys? Are you dating white guys? Like all of that stuff, right? And so I just had to spend a lot of time thinking about it, which, you know, this is one of these hidden privileges that white people get in this country, right? Is that we're not raised to ever have to think about the fact that we have a race, right? And we do, right? We're white, we get given privileges and so on and so forth, but we're trained to think that we should be colorblind and not see race. And that just gives like white supremacy more power, right? Because it's hidden, so you can't fight it. So writing that first book was sort of my chance to be like, oh, like I am definitely getting treated differently, you know, because most people just, life is hard. You work a lot. You want to spend time with your family. Most people don't have time to sit around and be like, I wonder why I was treated that way at work today. Right. You're just like, oh, thank God I got through the day. Right. So it was really special for me to do that book that then bled into this one. Right. Because that, you know, that book published in 2012. Right. You have Trayvon Martin, you have Mike Brown, you have all those things happening and sort of like that level of racism becoming much more apparent. And then for me, as we got into the Trump election, I just, you know, I write about this in the foreword to the book. You know, I was just like, I knew this. I knew this. I wasn't surprised when Donald Trump was elected. I was more like, oh, that's what I expected. And I talked myself out of it because I'm in these elite circles with very progressive people, right, on the coast who don't understand how hard it is for white people outside of their bubble. Right. Because one thing Donald Trump was very effective at, right, was taking very real economic fear and instability, which is, I mean, rife throughout the industrial Midwest and rural areas, right, and start blaming it on race, right, and sort of active. And I'm not saying there wasn't racism there in the first place, but really pouring fuel on that fire, right? And being like, oh, like you feel unstable. Well, that's because like immigrants or Black people are taking your jobs. Right. And sort of activating that. And you see that again and again in American history, right? That none of this is new. But it was really being able to do that first book that led me to this one.
You know, it is amazing because, like I said, sometimes when I was reading some of the write up on you, I felt like, wait a minute. Are we sourcing the same things? Or wait a minute, is she a closet person listening to some of the stuff we talk about or what? You know, because, you know, it's just amazing that the same conclusions that are coming from it. And what I love about it is these conclusions are coming from a white journalist, right? And the problem that I find, and this is where I'll go into the question about the myopia within the journalism, right? Because as it turns out, there are a lot of problems that have I call it a racial economic component. First of all, I'm the one that on my program always say race is one of the stupidest things out there, period. Bar none, race is the stupidest thing out there, because technically speaking, and I don't even want to go into the subjects, but after you've lived together for a long time and see your wants, your ifs, your needs, and you find out, oh my God, you mean I care about my kid just as much as you do? You mean I care about these things just as much as you? You mean I even put my pants on just like you do? It's sort of a silly thing, right? That we just make pigmentation have such an effect on people. Now, as it turns out, like I said, when I read some of the passages and when I see it, it is like, why is it that journalists, the people who should be doing the investigative things, don't kind of open the door to Americans like your book will to quite a few people, especially given the source? Why is it that they're not doing their job and they're making the narrative come from those who have an ulterior motive in creating a false narrative?
Right. Well, I mean, I don't think that there's like a conspiracy afoot, right? But I just think that, you know, white Americans don't learn the truth about racism in our country, right? Or about race, right? We don't learn, like, you can absolutely be raised in America as a white person and not have to understand anything about how racism works, not have to understand that race affects you as a white person, not understand that it probably shaped your family's economic circumstance, right? There is no person of color in this country who doesn't understand that being white often opens financial doors for you, right? So one of the weird tricks with this book is that, you know, like, I talk to like white people and they're like, wow, I never really thought about how being white could be valuable, right? And people of color are like, the white bonus, I've been wanting a phrase for that. I've been watching this my whole life. Like, thank you for the phrase, right? So it's like a very different like thing. I mean, people ask me like, oh, who do you hope reads this? What do you want? I'm like, well, I hope for white people, it makes things like a little clearer, and both like opens up a conversation about what we get, so we can also be honest about what we lose because of racism in this country. We lose a lot, including most white people. Not as much as people of color, right? But we're still.
But you know, I'm gonna push back a bit. I think this book ought to be read by everybody, because I tell you, a black person reading this book gives them. On my program, I speak to everybody, and I try to get, whether they are rude to me, whether they call me by the epithets or whatever, I'm always one way and nice to them and try to get through them. And I think what your book does for somebody that isn't white is to let them see the vulnerabilities that being white has as well. Because in reading your narrative, many of the things I'm like, there are times I'm looking at it and say, oh my God. I mean, things that I know, but you know, when it's written, when you write it down, it's like, and you don't even realize it. I mean, when you make a statement like that part that you made where you said, a person like me shouldn't be on food stamps. That's a profound statement, because it's instantiated into the heads of many people, right? And the answer that I gave this morning, in fact, I said, do you know what it feels like when that person in Appalachia goes out there and see all those executive black folks that they normally would think, they were trained to believe a certain way things work, and they're having it hard as hell. And then Trump comes in with a false narrative, like they got there not on their merits, but because of something they're taking from you, you know, right. And that's why I try to bring a whole lot of that into the argument. And your book, I think, cauterized it in many ways for everybody to see that, but for the, you know, it is like, it's written for two audiences, right?
It's your book about the white people, but also, I mean, that's interesting. I hadn't thought so much about just being like, this is what it's like for broke white people. But for me, you know, I'm hopeful that if nothing else, right, the book just takes the responsibility for explaining this off from people of color and gives a little bit of cover, right? Like, I've been doing these public conversations and some folks of color in the audience have been like, well, how do I bring this up? Like, with my friends, like, you know, I have white people in my life that I care about, but this is a hard conversation. I'm like, well, I hope that at least like you could just be like, there's this book. Did you see it? And you can start that conversation. So it's not about like I individually have gone to my white friend to be like, we need to talk Susie, right? You're just like, Susie, I heard about this book. Have you seen this? Right? And can sort of open up that conversation in a way that's a little easier and for folks to navigate.
Yeah, and I think that is the case. You have to find whatever avenue that you can use to get to people. And like I said, I think telling stories, right? And the good thing about it is you told your story and you told other people's stories. So nobody, when you write the book, can't say this is just an academic exercise. This is an exercise in reality from somebody who's known poverty, from somebody who's known their whiteness, from somebody who's known all these things. So there's nothing that the guy in Appalachia or the guy in the boardroom can tell you with the experience that you put the book out with. Your thoughts?
Thank you. That's really nice. I mean, for me, I don't really get into academic like literature. And one of the reasons I work as a journalist is I want to be out there talking to real people and seeing how stuff works. Right. So like there's nobody in the book that's like a cartoon white person. Right. There's nobody that's a Karen. Right. There's nobody from Appalachia even. Right. That sort of stuff. Right. Everybody is like a middle class white person. Like from Connecticut to California, Mississippi, Texas, Michigan, Pennsylvania, right? And you can just sort of get a sense of like, all right, so for like these normal white folks, like how does this stuff work? How valuable is it? And what do we all lose, right? Because one thing that, I hadn't really thought through, one of my subjects, right, is a boomer age woman who fell into working poverty and ends up dying because there's no Medicaid, right? That's a very short thumbnail of it. And I think a lot of people would sort of look at that and be like, oh, well, but like, I'm not going to fall into working poverty, so it's not going to affect me. But I think, she had three sisters, right? So the narrative is very much about like their loss. Like I came to her story through them. She's already, she's gone before I wrote the story. And, her sisters are economically fine, right? But they lost their sister. And I think that's a really important thing, right? Is that even if you individually are stably middle class and you have equity in your home and you've been socking away for retirement and you think, I'm going to be fine in this system, somebody you love isn't going to be, right? You're going to know a young person who gets saddled with too much student debt, right? You're going to know somebody who needs public health care because they get a bad illness that is really serious and they can't afford it and they're out of pocket, right? All of that. And so the longer that we don't even address racism as a problem that everybody needs to worry about, right? The longer that stuff is just going to keep going. And I sort of picture this like, we built this system with like a hole in the floor that white people thought only Black people would fall through. And we didn't shore up the floor. We didn't repair the hole. And it's just getting bigger and bigger. And it's going to swallow more and more people unless we start doing something about it.
Well, and it's not the subject of your book, but you've just defined the ills of capitalism. But but anyway, I mean, not to bring up another subject, right. Let's talk a little bit about silence. Talk to me.
Oh, like white silence?
Yeah, talk to me.
Yeah, well, I think, a lot of white people stay silent about racism in this country. And for me, like the way that I understand that is both, we don't understand it. We don't understand that there's a bonus exactly because nobody tells us about it. And so we just sort of like go along being like, well, the system seems to be working okay. And I'm going to like hope it stands. But I, at least in my experience, I think abuse is really common in families, certainly sporadic, like off and on abuse. And particularly with white families, right? White middle class families, very few people want to intervene. Right. I mean, Black families that have difficulty with their kids, right, often will get policed by the foster care system. Right. White families often don't have that experience. Right. So you have all these kids growing up being treated poorly and nobody ever speaks up for them. Right. Nobody ever says this is bad. This is certainly what happened to me. Right. I write in the book about like a period during my upbringing when my father was being pretty violent and abusive. And what happened, right, is like everybody around me, right? I'm a 17-year-old kid, like in physical danger, and everybody was quiet about it, right? My my stepmother, my grandmother. I later learned that the teachers in my school system knew that there was probably abuse happening and said and did nothing, right? And I think that that trains people to stay silent about the abuse of other people, right? So if you come up and nobody cares about what's happening to you, why would you ever care about what's happening to other folks? And for me, again, that was part of the trick of using the memoir, right? Because I think it's both true that the experiences that I have had of abuse are probably the root of my deepest empathy around the experience of racism. When I hear folks talk about it, right, there's an echo there. It's the same mechanics, different scale, different heft, right? But it gives me an empathy. But it's also true that the way that abuse shaped my life at an early age meant that I, for a long time, I was a lot less likely to speak up or sort of stand up about things because, you know, the thinking is sort of like, well, I never got that. Why would I do it for somebody else? And so for me, I wanted to sort of pull that stuff out because I think, you know, the level of abuse that I experienced at home, I don't think it was very unusual, right? I think parenting is really hard. And I think a lot of parents like go through a period of like not being their best selves. And instead of talking about it, right, we just bury it. And I think that that has really profound reflections in our larger culture.
The silence within the culture can actually cause problems we don't even expect. It's interesting because you also speak about, and this goes with regards to getting services from the government or getting support, et cetera, where you talk about some people believe they deserve it, but expect others to prove that they must. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, you know, white Americans got a lot of help from the government, especially in the 20th century, right? So the creation of the American middle class, that was a government project that was aimed at white communities, right? So it wasn't written, this is only for white people, but was understood by government to largely be for white people. And it was understood that it would be implemented in a way that would really primarily benefit white people, right? But we never talk about that way, right? We say, oh, this is just what like white people get because it's what Americans get. Right. And it hides it. And so you have that. So you're hiding this bonus. You're just acting like it is normal, but it's not right. It's a gift from government, which everybody should get that. Right. I think that's like one thing like white people, I think, tend to get like, well, if I admit that this was given to me, then I'm going to have to give it back. It's like, well, no, we don't have to give it back. Like, we just have to share. Right. And like, that's fine. And then, right, because we think that we got this thing that we're entitled to, then we're like, well, but for special help, you have to prove it, right? Because there's limited resources, which is not as limited as most people think. And then you got to prove that you really deserve, like, you know, this help to like raise your family at home if you're not earning enough money, right? And things like that. And so, you know, I came to this work really in part because I spent the 1990s covering welfare reform, right, under Clinton, and sort of how that changed the social safety net in this country and turned it from something where if you were broke enough, you got help. And now you have to prove that you're trying to work, even though this goes on a long tangent, right? And those kinds of punitive policies have become more and more common as we've gone forward, right? So work requirements are part of cash assistance. They are part of food assistance often. And there's a sort of a movement in Republican-led states to add work requirements to Medicaid, right? Which keep getting struck down in the federal courts because it is actually statutorily contradictory to the law. Mm-hmm. Right? The law's intention is not anything about self-sufficiency or whatever language, which
it's about what's needed. Yeah.
Right. It's about you need to get people health care, right? Work requirements have nothing to do with that. But we keep making these systems more and more punitive. And it's this thing, right, where white people thought like we wouldn't be subject to that. And it's starting more and more, I think, to be hitting everybody.
Yeah. At the end of the book, this is a second to last statement. Well, I'm going to make a statement, then I'm going to ask you the last question. At the end of the book, you have a difficult correspondence with your dad. I'm not going to ask you to go through that specifically, but I just want to tell you that at the end, the last paragraph was a gem because you said something that I think people need to understand. And that is, things don't have to remain the way they are, neither our economy, our social beings, or anything. We have the ability to make that change. And I love that. That is what that narrative implied. Our economy doesn't have to be the way it is. Things don't have to be the way it is. I think the more people learn that, the more people accept that it's within them to make the changes that are needed, the better meant for us all. But my last question is always the same, and that is, what would you have liked me to ask you that I didn't?
Oh, why have I been sitting here like strategizing about that? What would I like to be asked? You know, you didn't ask me about my grandfather.
I purposefully didn't ask you about your grandfather because for somebody who thinks that race is a stupid thing, right? I found the story interesting, but it was like, well, you know, if I were to take the blood of just about every white person in America today, they would show some African descent. But tell the story. Go ahead.
Right. So it's just that, you know, when I'm calculating the white bonus and going through my family, right, I realize that all of the inheritable wealth in my family really comes from one grandfather, right? I mean, there's some wealth on my mom's side, but really everything that got down to me came from my dad's dad, who's a banker, right? Became a banker in the 1920s when there were 250,000 bankers in the U.S. and only 80 were black, right? Had a racial covenant on his home. And I'm going through Canadian census records and find that, because he was born in Canada, that his mother, his uncles, and his grandfather are all categorized as African in the 1901 census, right? And it's interesting, right? There've been a few like online comments from folks who've read the book, and they're like, this completely like ruins the entire book. And I'm like, it doesn't, right? Because the whole point, and
why did they think it ruined the book?
I don't think they were reading very carefully, or they didn't get this idea, right? That race isn't real, right? Race is a fiction that we treat as real. So you have to worry about racism because we use skin color to apportion power, right? So we have to worry about it. But race as a thing, like, we made that up, right? Like, it is no more important to like your intelligence or your abilities than like your eye color, right? Like, this is ridiculous. And for me, it felt really important to flag that in the work, right? Particularly because that is something that showed up. I don't know how I would have worked that in otherwise. To be like, look, for all the power that we give to skin color, it's a fiction, right? Which means it could be different. We could do this stuff.
And I think that's great. I mean, I think the ultimate thing is that he made it because he passed.
Yeah.
He passed. So and that's the reason why I said, I don't see why people would think that changed the gist of the book. In fact, I think it enhances the book. If you take that down to its every level, it makes the book even more real. But anyway, look, Tracy McMillan, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, and thank you for writing this book. I think especially in these times, it's a necessary book.
Thank you very much, Egberto. This was really awesome. Thank you for being so thoughtful.
We spend a lot of time deconstructing the news, trying to parse it into a form that everybody can understand. We try to find those little nitpicks where it flies above the fray, etc. If you really like these videos that we do, I want to ask a big favor. Please go ahead, number one, subscribe to our channel, and number two, please join if you can. Thank you so kindly for watching. Keep watching. Please remember to share. We must populate the entire internet with our progressive message, a message that we know is what most Americans say that they want. So help us, please join. I hope you guys enjoyed that that interview. I really enjoyed speaking to her. I think the book that she wrote, I think, is going to be one of the important books, especially since what she did is a whole lot of quantification of what does it mean to be, you know, I mean, you hear a lot of people that talk about, even here in the chat, oh, black people get an advantage here, or people of color get an advantage there, and it shows, I'll be as respectful as I can, but it shows a shallowness and an inability to really think things through, right? I mean, something as simple as knowing that many middle-class families got into the middle class with the GI Bill. Many middle-class families got into the middle class with what Roosevelt did. So a lot of the work Roosevelt did with many of the governmental plans that were designed to put people into the middle class. Many people sort of ignore that a lot of us gain most of our wealth accumulative wealth from our homes. And if we had redlining where one was unable to right price their homes, effectively those who could right price their homes would be ahead financially over everyone else. And we all know that one's financial status has a lot to do with the growth of said family. I mean, these things are mathematically quantifiable, et cetera. And for folks to deny these things either shows one of two things. One is a willful ignorance, right? The other is, which is malicious in its own right. But another one is a true maliciousness in one's thinking. And I don't know which one it is for many of the folks in here, but it's something that one should ponder. The problems in this country with race, and it's great to see someone like Macmillan actually quantify that. And I tell you, one of the things that she did, what Tracy did, and I'm going to see if I can put it on the screen real quick. I think it's an important graph that she made. And yeah, I think I'll be able to get that graph on the screen. Let me just shut a few things out here. And then I will be able to show you that graph. What she decided to do is she decided that she was going to make a chart that defined what she the advantage that she got quantified from being white. And she tells you how she does it, right? And I'm going to put it on the screen now, and you'll see it. That is her. This is what she called Tracy's white bonus. And she has white bonus based on her family and white bonus just based on who she is. And if you take a look at those numbers, quantifiable numbers, right? She went and did the analysis as what it meant to her. What has her whiteness given her? So you guys can make a screenshot of that if you want to or whatever, but she did a great job in putting this together. And the more people tend to deny these things, the more they deny it, you know, it really doesn't matter because we know it. We've lived, many of us who sit here, we know it, we've lived it. So it's not something that, you know, what's the word that I want to say? It's not something that's debatable. It's quantifiable. Anyhow, let's see what else we got here. Anybody has, Egberto, please post a link to that image screenshot in the video. Isn't a good quality. Yeah, I let me see if I have, because I got a, this is just a document that I have here. But I'm going to try to get it for you because you're correct. I may be able to do that, you know. I may be able to do that. Let's see. Para ver cómo lo hago. Rodney, I'm going to have to do it after because that is inside of my OneNote folder, and I need to put it in a better way to get it to you. So that's something I'll do for you. But yeah, it is important for us to start looking at things for the way they really are on that what we kind of, oh, we thought this is how things were. No, that's not it at all. That's not it at all. Anyway, let's see what else we got here. Let me go to the chat and see if there's anything that I have to get. Egberto, if you need a web link to image, it's my favorite. Look at Michael Rudden, always has an answer. Here you go. You like IMGVV? Okay, I tell you what, I can actually do that likely on the fly. I can probably do that even as I'm speaking. I can probably do that for you just because you're asking, Mr. Rudnin. You know, I aim to please my viewers. I aim to please, well, I call you viewers, but you know your family. I aim to please, and I'm going to try to get that for you right now. Anyway, what else is up, folks? Anything else you guys want to talk about? That, given that it was a long interview, I hope that we'd have anybody who wants to have a discussion and talk about it, let me know. Put it in the chat or give me a call. You guys have the numbers, 281-823-7747. 281-823-7747. I'd love to hear from anyone who wants to talk about it, who wants to add their two cents to it as well. Let's see. Let me just go ahead and put, I want to name it. I'm going to just name it Tracy. There we go. Tracy. All right. Michael, I should be able to put that up in there in short order, I believe. Let's see. Lee Grant says, Melanie Phillips has noted. Wait a second. I'm going to go to that in a minute as soon as I go ahead and upload this stuff for Mr. Rudnin, which is being uploaded. Let's see if I can copy the link. All right, Mr. Rudnin, you asked for it. I think I have your link for you. There's a link. All right. Lee Grant says, Melanie Phillips has noted, overnight last night, a mob storm in Colombia. I'm not talking about the Colombia issue. And the reason why is everything is out on mainstream media. There's nothing else to say about it. Is there an Ask Egberto this Saturday? Yes, Melanie, we will have an Ask Egberto this Saturday. Please go to politicsunright.com/askegberto to get your link. Sign up for it. All right. Got saved to bookmark. There you go. And Michael Rudnin went ahead and got it saved already. He's so quick in getting these things done. All right. I'll put it over so that everybody can see it now in the right dimensions. There we go. All right. What else have we got? Colombia is a great example of no accountability. Really? Is that what that is? I think Netanyahu is a great example of no accountability. I think hopefully the ICC will put him put an arrest warrant out for him. I can't wait for that to occur because we want he's no less a pariah than Putin. So it would be great as soon as that arrest warrant is issued for him. All right, what else have we got here? Let's see. Egberto posts a link to the image. Let me go ahead. The middle class is becoming poorer thanks to current leaders who know nothing about foreign or domestic affairs and continue to experiment. They keep trying. No, that's not the reason why. But I know that's the reason why your people tell you it is. And by your people, I mean the right-wing people that don't know what they're talking about. Let's see. Lee Grant says, truth be told, black banks redlined also. Oh, my God. I'm not going to touch that one. All right. Mike Cisek says, Marxists are constantly trying to pitch one group of people against another. Really? You're the one who just came out and said that black people get all these things from the government, Mr. Cisek. Who's pitching who against who? Who's pitching who against who? All right. Let's see what else. Egberto showing the read the book. I read the book in excerpts, and I confessed that to her. I told her I didn't have the time to read this 300 and something page book, but I strategically read sections of the book. And also I must admit she had a great publicist. Michael says, correct. Marxists are always trying to pitch two groups against each other. The filter rich versus everyone else. In other words, the proletariat against the you know whom. So yeah, thank you, Rudnin, for actually specifying a truth few know about, because they use some buzzwords, but they don't know what they're talking about. Eric says, this is a reality. EV4, the electric vehicle, reported a $1.3 billion loss. And are you happy about that? Are you happy about an electric car where we're trying to do something positive, lost money? Is that something to celebrate? Or is that something to say we need to work on getting some efficiencies up? And by the way, that $1.3 billion, don't take it at face values. A lot of companies, because there are a lot of government subsidies for electric cars, they may be doing that to simply go ahead and get subsidies and breaks, etc. But anyway, I know you don't quite get that, El Señor Hayes, but that's what a whole lot of companies do. All right, we are at 51, and I am going to the interview was the only thing that I had for today, so I am going to just go ahead and do my ask. But before I do my ask, I'd like to know if anybody wants to call in. That is 281-823-7747. Egberto, grace face plant into palm. You must express well done. Thank you, brother. Thank you, brother. All right. Again, anybody want to call in to say anything? 281-823-7747. Alternatively, I will start working on my ask to ask all of our viewers to consider being a supporter of Politics Done Right and the entire media spectrum that we do. I don't know how many of you know, but if you want to see all the platforms that we populate on a daily basis, I'm going to put it in here. I should have put this some. I thought I had this in my thing, but let me do it here. PoliticsDoneRight.com/info. If you want to get to all the platforms that we do, and I'm going to put it on the screen, what it looks like. From here, from this link here, you can get to all of our platforms, all meaning all our from TikTok to Instagram to YouTube, to Facebook, LinkedIn, X, formerly known as Twitter, or podcasts, all our worldwide web properties, or Patreon, PayPal, our books. All of that, I created this link called politicsdoneright.com/info. So please visit politicsdoneright.com/info. That can get you to some of our TikToks and all the other things that we do. You want to take a look at what that looks like? If you take a look at how our TikTok page looks, there you go. And you see all the little framings that we do here on TikTok. If you want to see how our different pages on Instagram look, you can see our Instagram pages and how we transfer all this info. So we are a full multimedia informational agent. If you take a look at our X, Twitter, it's there as well. So if you go to politicsdoneright.com/info, it gets you to every part of our media operation. And what I'm asking is that people support that best they can. One way to support it is via Patreon, politicsandright.com/patreon, politicsandright.com/support is the way that gives you all the different options that we have for you to support the program. We also have politicsandright.com/newsletter. I'm asking all of you that are listening to the program, please consider becoming a paid member of our newsletter. How do you do that? Go to politicsandright.com/newsletter. And again, anybody who subscribed to our newsletter or Patreon get access to all of our books. All of our books, the 5 books that I've written, and all subsequent books you'll be able to read online at our website or at the Substack platform. So please consider supporting us the best that you can. We're here to support. If you want to get our books, you can go get our books at politicsdoneright.com/books, politicsdoneright.com/books. And there's a link to politicsdoneright.com/books. But once again, I ask you all to become paid members of our newsletter, where we get a whole lot of information out as well. politicsdoneright.com/newsletter. My name is Egberto Willis. This is Politics Done Right. I want to thank you all for being here, for listening, but I got to get out of here. So my name is Egberto Willis. This is Politics Done Right. And you guys know how I end this, baby. I am what? Out.
We spend a lot of time deconstructing the news, trying to parse it into a form that everybody can understand. We try to find those little nitpicks where it flies above the fray, etc. If you really like these videos that we do, I want to ask a big favor. Please go ahead, number one, subscribe to our channel, and number two, please join if you can. Thank you so kindly for watching. Keep watching. Please remember to share. We must populate the entire internet with our progressive message, a message that we know is what most Americans say that they want. So help us, please join.